Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1198, I will have a few segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, including the Israeli genocide in the Gaza Strip. After that, I will air a few of the remarks delivered at the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey, on media coverage and its complicity in the genocide in Gaza. We will listen to the remarks of Katie Halper, journalist, filmmaker, podcaster, political commentator, and host of the Katie Halper Show, speaking about media complicity in the genocide. Well, then hear from Lubna Masara, journalist and Middle East Eyes, Palestine and Israel bureau chief based in Jerusalem, discussing the difficulties of reporting on the ongoing genocide. And then we'll hear from Asal Raad, a scholar of modern Middle Eastern history, a fellow at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C., and author of The State of Resistance, Politics, Culture, and Identity in Modern Iran, speaking about the underlying biases of Western media. Finally, I will air portions of the remarks delivered by Palestinian journalist and writer Saja Hamdan at an event at SOAS University of London, in which she discusses how governments and media outlets have turned a blind eye to Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, presented by Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Burrows-Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 816 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. After more than 80 days into the so-called ceasefire agreement signed in October 2025, Israel continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip while bombing, shelling, and destroying areas across the vague yellow line, a line which is constantly moving further westwards. Israel is also still preventing the entry of shelters and basic supplies during brutal storms and freezing temperatures, while tents are flooded and partially destroyed buildings collapse on top of people. At least three Palestinians were injured when Israeli soldiers targeted the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, with witnesses saying the attack happened in an area from which Israeli forces had withdrawn under the purported ceasefire agreement. Israel carried out an air raid on the eastern areas of Burej camp in central Gaza, as well as artillery shelling east of Rafah and in eastern parts of Gaza City. The Gaza government media office stated on Sunday that Israel has committed 969 violations of the ceasefire agreement in the past 80 days, resulting in 418 Palestinians killed and more than 1,100 wounded. Such violations include nearly 300 direct shooting incidents against civilians, 54 military incursions into residential areas, 455 bombings and targeted attacks on Palestinians, and more than 160 bombings of homes, institutions, and other civilian buildings. Quote, the Gaza Strip is facing a slow death as the occupation continues to evade its obligations under the agreement and humanitarian protocols. It has failed to deliver even the minimum agreed upon amounts of aid, the media office said, adding that Israel's ongoing refusal to let in the necessary quantities of food, medicine, water, and fuel is deepening the catastrophic humanitarian crisis. Only 42% of the expected humanitarian aid has been allowed in, while only 10% of the needed fuel trucks have entered, leaving hospitals, bakeries, and water and sanitation facilities unable to operate. The media office reiterated its previous warnings about the deepening, deliberate crisis for Palestinians during the winter months as Israel prevents the entry of prefabricated caravans and shelter materials, which remain just kilometers away on the other side of the crossings. quote, "We emphasize that the continuation of these violations constitutes a dangerous circumvention of the ceasefire and an attempt to impose a humanitarian equation based on subjugation, starvation, and extortion," the media office stated, adding that "we hold the Israeli occupation fully responsible for the ongoing deterioration of the humanitarian situation and for the lives lost and property destroyed during a period when a complete and sustainable ceasefire is supposed to be in place." The illegal Israeli blockade and ban on the entry of temporary housing units have effectively eliminated all options for thousands of families, forcing them to remain in destroyed or severely damaged homes that have become time bombs liable to collapse at any moment, said Euromed Human Rights Monitor this week. The human rights group stated that, quote, "Israel is using the blockade as a tool of genocide and the creation of deadly living conditions by blocking reconstruction and repair, preventing the entry of materials and equipment needed to clear rubble and restore homes, water and sanitation systems, and electricity networks, and by obstructing humanitarian response efforts and undermining relief agencies' ability to provide even minimal protection." As a result, Euromed added, "Civilians are forced to choose between remaining in dilapidated buildings on the verge of collapse or sheltering in fragile tents that offer no protection from winter cold or rain." Mahmoud Bassal, the spokesperson for Gaza's civil defense, said that a recent storm coupled with Israel's deprivation of basic shelter materials killed at least two more Palestinians this week, including a woman who was killed when a weakened wall collapsed on top of her, and a 7-year-old child who fell into a water well and drowned during heavy rainfall. Quote, "We are living in a catastrophic reality created by this genocide on Gaza, where there is no infrastructure, no safe areas, and no areas suitable for living," Bassal stated. He said Palestinians have known neither rest nor safety since the start of the genocide, and that without the restoration of basic services and life-sustaining infrastructure, more people will die in the days ahead. In another statement, Bassal said on Monday that at least 18 buildings have completely collapsed, resulting in significant human and material losses, and more than 110 residential buildings have partially collapsed, posing a direct threat to the lives of thousands of residents living inside or near them. The civil defense spokesman emphasized that, quote, "tents have proven completely ineffective in the Gaza Strip, offering no protection from the cold or rain, and are no longer a viable humanitarian solution under these harsh conditions." Reporter Badr Tabash recorded footage of seawater flooding a tent camp in Mawasi Khan Yunis on Sunday, submerging shelters and destroying what little belongings families have left. Tabash recorded another video of the flooding, which was highlighted by the social media collective Translating Palestine, who added, quote, "For thousands forced to live meters from the shoreline after being expelled from their homes, the sea has become another threat, exposing how displacement sites offer no protection from weather, flooding, or basic risks to life. Still, the U.S. and the Israeli occupation continue to block all forms of shelter from entering the Strip." That's from reporter Badr Tabash over the weekend. Gaza's civil defense says that 25 Palestinians, including 6 children, have died due to the extreme cold and lack of proper shelters, including building collapses since the start of the winter season. On Monday, a 2-month-old baby, Arkan Firas Musleh, was the latest infant to die as a result of the extreme cold, Al Jazeera reported. Gaza's Ministry of Health also announced the death of a Palestinian man when a building collapsed onto a tent in the Tel al-Hawa neighborhood of Gaza City on Monday. 4 out of every 5 children in Gaza will enter the new year still facing crisis levels of hunger, despite the agreement by Israeli authorities 2 months ago to allow more aid including food, according to the international charity Save the Children, following the recent release of new data on hunger and malnutrition. The Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, or IPC, the leading international authority on the severity of hunger crises, published a new report warning that 1.6 million people in Gaza, or 77% of the population, including about 800,000 children, will continue facing acute food insecurity into 2026, especially since Israel continues to prevent the entry of dairy, meat, eggs, fish, and fresh produce into Gaza markets. Ahmed Al-Handawi, a regional director for Save the Children, stated, quote, "As the year draws to a close and some people start to sit back, do not be fooled into thinking the suffering in Gaza is over. Far from it. Hunger and malnutrition bring multiple physical harms to children's bodies, but the impacts are not just short-term. We know from experience that for any community, widespread malnutrition has lifelong consequences for people, from underweight newborns and stunted growth in early childhood to reduced learning and earning potential later in life, perpetuating cycles of poverty. As well as inflicting harm on individuals, these are consequences that threaten the very fabric of Palestinian society for generations to come." Al-Handawi added that, quote, "Gaza cannot become a dumping ground for the worst of humanity. These are ordinary children and families who just want to pick up their lives after years of horror. But day after day, a safe and healthy future gets further out of reach." Because of Israel's blockade on fuel, medical staff at Al-Awda Hospital in Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza reported that electricity was out for at least 2 days this week, forcing all departments to shut down, putting patients at serious risk. Journalist Anwar Abuslihe, reporting from the darkened hospital, recorded himself on December 27th, saying that the crisis left the intensive care unit, the radiology department, operating rooms, and emergency reception out of service. He said that the hospital's director, Dr. Rifat Al-Majdalawi, highlighted the crisis particularly for pregnant women, as Al-Awda is the only medical facility in central Gaza that can provide maternity and delivery services. And it has been 1 year since the director of Kamal Adwan Hospital, the pediatrician Dr. Hossam Abu Safiya, was abducted by Israeli forces from the facility and since subjected to systematic torture inside Israeli detention camps. He was taken hostage after the army besieged and bombed the hospital, targeted and killed his child, shot him with a quadcopter drone while he was attending to patients, and destroyed the hospital over and over again. Since his abduction on December 27, 2024, Dr. Hossam Abu Safiya has been held in Israeli torture prisons under the designation of unlawful combatant, a draconian classification that allows indefinite detention without charge or trial. In October, as we reported at the time, Dr. Abu Safiya's lawyer confirmed that an Israeli court rubber-stamped the extension of his arbitrary detention for 6 months, or until April 2026. He has been systematically beaten, tortured, denied medical attention, and has been subjected to deliberate starvation, losing 40 kilograms of his body weight, according to his legal team. Dr. Abu Safiya's family has been regularly posting updates on his plight and his deteriorating health condition. This week, marking 1 year of the doctor's brutal captivity, his family posted the following statement. "In this white coat, he walked alone amidst death, destruction, and in front of tanks, not because he was fearless, but because his oath and his humanity were greater than any fear. He refused to abandon the children and the wounded at the hospital, and for that, he was detained. This image is a testament to the courage of the man who was the last line of defense for life, and it is the very same scene that ended with his unjust arrest. A full year of injustice has passed. Today, we ask for nothing but his freedom. Please share his story to keep his voice alive," Dr. Hossam Abu Safiya's family stated. On Monday, the Qassam Brigades officially announced that their longtime spokesman, Hudhaifa Samir Abdallah Al-Kahlout, who used the nom de guerre Abu Obeida, had been killed along with his wife and children in an Israeli attack on his home in August. One son, Ibrahim, is reportedly the only one who survived. A new spokesman who adopted the same moniker of Abu Obeida made the announcement on Monday. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight gutted Gaza buildings, a last resort for families seeking shelter, by Huda Skaik, writing from Gaza. Around Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, entire structures and buildings lean at sharp angles, their floors and ceilings sagging as if melting, and staircases hang in midair. These rain-soaked ruins are not fit for habitation. They are so unstable that one gust of wind or a night of heavy rain could bring them down. Yet displaced people are living inside them due to a lack of tents and available space at shelters across Gaza. "I went to schools and shelters, but no one accepted us," Sumaya Nabhan, 32, said. "There was simply no space. I have an injured husband and three children. If I had a tent, even if it meant living in the street, I would choose it over this building." Before the genocide, Nabhan and her family lived in a modest, single-room home in the northern Gaza Strip area of Tal el-Zatar, but that home was destroyed by Israeli strikes. For the past 7 months, they have squatted in this tilted building in Al Rimal neighborhood, which lists so heavily to the right that visitors instinctively brace their bodies against the slope. "Even the tea kettle is tilted," Nabhan said. Nabhan and her husband cleared just enough rubble to squeeze inside the building, but the roof leaks like an open pipe whenever it rains, and stray dogs wander in at night. "I stay awake all night guarding my children from the dogs," she said. "What does this house mean to me?" she said. "Shelter. Nothing in life matters more, not even food." Social media users and news outlets have documented numerous buildings collapsing in Gaza and Palestinians being trapped under the rubble of buildings that, damaged by Israeli strikes, have subsequently collapsed under winter rain. Sumaya Nabhan said the danger of living in such a structure haunts her, yet her housing options are severely limited, as 81% of all the structures in Gaza are damaged as of October 2025, according to UN analysis of satellite imagery. "I live with sadness and despair," she said. "Sometimes I wish for death rather than this. Her only dream now is a closed tent. I feel like I'm living somewhere unfit for humans," she said. Islam Al-Faram, 37, has pitched a tent on what used to be the front yard of her home, in between two partially collapsed structures that lean at dangerous angles. "Stones fall from them," she said of the neighboring buildings. "Today, stones fell on us because of the rain." Al-Faram and her husband cleared the rubble from their old home in Al-Rimal until they could erect tarps where the yard once was. "They decided to stay here because this was their home, even if only the ground beneath it remains. This place holds our memories," she said. "Even if we're in a tent, it feels like part of our soul is still here." Those are excerpts from Gutted Gaza Buildings, A Last Resort for Families Seeking Shelter, by Huda Skaik, writing from Gaza on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. Despite 27 months of an ongoing genocide, the graduating class of a new cadre of doctors stood together in celebration after passing their board exams in front of one of the burned-out buildings of Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City last week. The Ministry of Health in Gaza said that these doctors are part of the Shield of Humanity cohort and stated, quote, "Despite the genocide, you are the cure." And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. On December 30, 2025, apartheid Israel decided to ban 37 international humanitarian organizations from doing any aid work in the Gaza Strip, including Doctors Without Borders, in an attempt to speed up the genocide it is inflicting on the Gaza Strip, and another way to prevent anyone from the outside world to see what Israel is doing to the 2.3 million Palestinians inside Gaza. Of course, Israel has banned journalists from entering the Gaza Strip to report on its atrocities and war crimes for over 2 years, and has been targeting and murdering Palestinian journalists inside Gaza who were covering the Israeli genocide. More than 278 journalists, along with their families, were targeted and killed by apartheid Israel over the past 2 years. Western media complicity is covering up and turning a blind eye to apartheid Israel's war crimes, atrocities, and genocide in Gaza has been noticeable over the past 2 years. During the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey in October 2025, one of the topics discussed was media complicity in the genocide in Gaza. Several speakers delivered remarks at that event, and I'm going to share some of them now. Let's begin with the remarks of Katie Halper, journalist, filmmaker, podcaster, political commentator, and host of the Katie Halper Show, speaking about media complicity in the genocide.
My name is Katie Halper. I'm a journalist, filmmaker, and the host of YouTube shows, podcasts, and a radio show. And I'm here to speak in my capacity as an analyst of Western corporate media. I'm also here as someone who personally experienced Western corporate media censorship and cancellation. In 2020, while working as a co-host of Hill TV's show Rising, I prepared a daily monologue in which I argued that Israel was an apartheid state. The producers refused to air my segment, and when I urged them to do so, they responded by letting me go from a show I had been on for over 2 years. That was 5 years ago. In the last 2 years since October 7th, American media coverage of the war in Gaza has not only remained biased, but, along with Western corporate media, I will argue, has been complicit in genocide. Western corporate media's complicity is so pervasive and in some cases quantifiable. It often uses passive voice and non-attribution in headlines to describe Israel's killing of Palestinians. It uses emotive language to describe the deaths of Israelis. In November 2023, the New York Times sent a memo to its reporters telling them not to use the words genocide, ethnic cleansing, or occupied territory. It even cautioned against the use of refugee camp. In late October and early November, CNN emailed its reporters to, quote, remind our audiences of the immediate cause of this current conflict, namely the Hamas attack and mass murder and kidnap of Israeli civilians. It also said, Hamas representatives are engaging in inflammatory rhetoric and propaganda. Most of it has been said many times before and is not newsworthy. We should be careful not to give it a platform. Because of time limits, I will focus in particular on the way Western corporate media manufactured consent for genocide through its selective and dishonest coverage of rape and sexual assault, which didn't merely misrepresent reality, but inverted it in order to dehumanize Palestinians. The corporate Western media spread the lie that Hamas engaged in mass systematic campaign of rape and sexual assault on October 7th. This same media ignored the documented mass systematic campaign of rape and sexual assault engaged in by Israel against Palestinians. Through its rape coverage, Western media parrots Israeli lies, which are then parroted by Western politicians. This lie was based in large part on a New York Times piece called Screams Without Words, How Hamas Weaponized Sexual Violence on October 7th. It reported that a New York Times investigation, quote, uncovered new details showing a pattern of rape, mutilation, and extreme brutality against women in the attacks on Israel. But the article was so shoddy that the editors canceled the podcast episode they had planned to do on it when New York Times staff rebelled. The family of one of the subjects of the piece didn't just push back on the journalist's claims that their relative had been raped, but said he had misrepresented himself. Every single witness who came forward has been discredited. On CNN, Dana Bash spent an entire segment asking Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal to condemn Hamas's rape of Israeli women. I'm going to actually show a clip of this because I think it perfectly captures how Western media uses atrocity propaganda to justify actual propagandas. Please play the video.
15,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes, three quarters of whom are women and children.
And it's horrible, but you don't see Israeli soldiers raping
Well, Dana, I think we're not...
Okay, so just to reiterate what happened there, Pramila Jayapal, after having been asked to condemn Hamas rape several times during an interview with Dana Bash, did condemn Hamas's alleged rape. Of course, the word alleged was not used. But then Pramila Jayapal had the gall to encourage Dana Bash to show some bias and talk about the outrages committed against Palestinians and mention the death of 15,000 civilians. And Dana Bash's response was, "And it's horrible, but you don't see Israeli soldiers raping Palestinian women." And this is a quintessential example of how atrocity propaganda is being used to launder and justify actual atrocities. It brings up the rape to downplay Israel's actions. It implies that Israelis are enlightened and evolved humans who do not and would not engage in sexual violence. Palestinians, however, are savage rapists. Or, as Israel's then Defense Minister Yoav Gallant put it on October 9, 2023, "We are fighting human animals and we act accordingly." The Israeli government, Israeli media, Western corporate media, and Western politicians engage in a mutually reinforcing feedback loop of propaganda. For example, Hillary Clinton, Facebook CEO Sheryl Sandberg, and a group of scholars joined together to speak about the use of sexual violence as a weapon of war, invoking Hamas as an example. Sheryl Sandberg made a documentary on this. During the vice presidential debate, Kamala Harris used the rape hoax, much like Bashhead, to justify Israel's actions, saying, "On October 7th, women were horribly raped, and so absolutely, I said then and I say now, Israel has a right to defend itself." And while this mass campaign of rape was concocted to rally hate, media and political elites ignored the actual rape perpetuated by Israelis against Palestinians. And I also want to acknowledge Sahar Francis for her excellent presentation yesterday, where she actually relayed the testimony of rapes and sexually abused and tortured Palestinians, and this testimony is utterly absent from Western media's coverage. I will focus on one instance of sexual violence in which Israeli soldiers literally, and excuse my language here, but gang raped a Palestinian prisoner on video at the notorious Sde'i Tamon detention facility in the Negev desert. And unlike the alleged Hamas rapes, this was also documented. The systematic sexual abuse of Palestinians by Israelis has been documented by human rights organizations and, as we'll see, Israeli society and video. So in this video, we see a prisoner dragged behind the soldier's shields. But it was so obvious that he was sexually assaulted that the Israeli media reported it as such. He was then hospitalized, by the way, and unable to walk. When Israeli police detained some of the alleged rapists, Israelis rioted, not against the rape or the rapist, but against the arrest of the rapists in protests that have been dubbed right to rape protests. These protests were attended by members of the government. Nobody denied it. A member of the Knesset even said that, quote, "inserting sticks into people's rectums was, quote unquote, legitimate." There's video of a rabbi blessing a rapist, and one of the rapists became a star and celebrity. And yet neither Kamala Harris nor Dana Bash mentioned this. The New York Times did cover this incident very briefly in an article called "Israeli Military Prosecutor Charges Five Reservists with Abuse of Detainees." And you can obviously contrast that language with the extremely inflammatory language used in the headline about the screams without words, the Hamas rape. Okay, the article read, "At one point, one of the soldiers stabbed him with a sharp object, causing a tear in his rectal wall." This did not appear until the seventh paragraph, and there was no use of the word rape or sexual violence. So the US media and Western media and US political elites are still talking about the rape that didn't happen, yet have been silent on a campaign of sexual violence that has been recorded. In fact, we have a UNN report that says that rape is being used as a method of war by Israel. We have also documentation by B'Tselem and countless Palestinian human rights organizations. B'Tselem wrote that prisoners are subject to repeated use of sexual violence by soldiers or prison guards. Western corporate media has abandoned journalistic principles and practice to win public support for the Gaza genocide. Human rights lawyer Craig McIver directs us to the historical precedents for holding Western media responsible for their role. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights guarantees, quote, the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media, regardless of frontiers. But the same document warns, nothing in this declaration may be interpreted as implying for any state, group, or person any right to engage in any activity or to perform any act aimed at the destruction of any of the rights and freedoms set forth herein. The United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Crime of Genocide doesn't merely make genocide punishable, but also public incitement to commit genocide and complicity in genocide. Even before the founding of the United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Crime of Genocide, the Nuremberg trial found newspaper publisher Julius Streicher guilty of incitement to genocide. One of the things, by the way, his newspaper pushed was the idea that Jewish men were violating German women's bodies, interestingly enough. Decades later, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda convicted three media figures of incitement to genocide. As scurrilous as the conduct of the Western corporate press has been over the last 2 years, we have had a shining example of what journalism can look like in the work and voices of Palestinian journalists, over 200 of whom have been killed for doing their work in these last 2 years. The targeted murdering of Palestinian colleagues makes Western corporate journalists complicit in these crimes all the worse. So I urge the jury to hold the media accountable for their complicity in genocide. Thank you very much.
That was Katie Halper, journalist, filmmaker, podcaster, political commentator, and host of The Katie Halper Show, speaking about media complicity in the genocide at the Gaza Tribunal final session. Let's listen next to Lubna Massara, journalist and Middle East Eyes Palestine and Israel bureau chief based in Jerusalem, discussing the difficulties of reporting on the ongoing genocide during the media roundtable held at the Gaza Tribunal final session.
To be honest, this is the first time I attend an event in the past 2 years, especially in this past 18 months. I think I feel speechless. This is the most documented genocide in the modern history. And the worst media Western coverage as well in modern history. So I just feel like there's not much I can add. And I even feel shy as a Palestinian who live in Jerusalem to speak about my own difficulties, because the true heroes are the Palestinian journalists in Gaza who are paying their life as a price to bring the truth to you outside. This is alongside of the silence of the mainstream media, the political elites in Europe, the US and the Western governments, which put a lot of responsibility on us as Palestinian journalists, as alternative platforms as well of news, such as Middle East Eye, 972, Al Jazeera, and most of all, the citizen journalism, which is in the shoulders of many young journalists in Gaza, like Bissan, like Hendel Khoudary, like many others who are risking their life every day to bring the truth for us, and being an alternative for I don't know even how to call the role the Western media played in this period, very shameful. We are shocked of the scale of the crimes, genocide, killing, destruction, but also we are shocked of the role of the Western media in this genocide. So it had been shocking for all of us as Palestinians how they can watch our life being eliminated, starvation, bodies, remains of bodies, babies being burned, and still being somehow silent about what's going on, and taking part in dehumanization of Palestinians. We could see that also in the way of coverage when Western media cover Israeli victims. They always have history. They always have life story, love story. They have names. They have everything, even the light in their faces. I remember the Times put the face of one of the mothers of the hostages. The light, the color, everything look different. While when it's coming to Palestinian victims, it's always mass. If in a good case, it's numbers. Even many massacres are not being covered in the media. Or for example, when there was the deal of releasing hostages / prisoners, the media will not even write children. They will write minors or teenagers or any way to dismiss our human life. So I do think for me, to this 18 months had been very massive. I wake up every morning, I watch hundreds of movies, of short movies from, not movies, but material that I receive from my journalists in Khan Yunis, in Rafah, in North Gaza. I see a lot of bodies, a lot of hands, a lot of heads, a lot of grief, cry, mothers trying to identify the bodies of their children in mass graves. And it's shocking for me every day, the gap of what I witness, what I see, and the way it's covered is shocking for me. And I'm just speaking randomly. I didn't prepare. I wrote here a few notes, but it doesn't matter. I think it's mostly exposed for us something deeper, because we could argue in the past about they don't know. So all the young Palestinians will be that fixers running with that white journalist in Palestine and to teach them and educate them about what's going on. But now they know, we can't say they are ignorant, right? We all, with WhatsApp, with Instagram, passing more and more footage of beheaded babies, burned children, bodies mixed with a flour of people who went to get food and to get flour and being murdered. And still it's not changing. And I think it's putting us in a new fact of like, who are the victims? Who's dying? What is skin color? What is, where he's coming from? Is he Ukrainian or is he Palestinian? And this is where we have, as a Palestinians, we had a gathering a month ago in Nazareth, in 48 Palestine, to start finding, thinking together, how to find the new platforms, how to tell our stories, because we can't rely anymore in Western media. And I want also to mention here something of mainstream media that entered Gaza in the Israeli tanks. This is very massive. And writing for Le Monde, for BBC, Haaretz, of course. This is, will not happen in Ukraine. They will not join a Russian tank and entering Ukraine. So there's something here, like media or Western media or mainstream Western media, let's say, let's be more correct on that, failed in covering and standing with the Palestinian people completely. And this is should be discussed, should be worked out. And I do think people in the ground, in the world, which I think give us also hope, we see the turning point in the streets. We see more people angry, more people active, and we providing more of our work for them. I cover Palestine as long as I wake up and my colleagues in the ground in Gaza and the West Bank wake up and still going and covering every morning for 600 days. They're still writing, they're insisting, and I think we should keep our work in all means. It's hard sometimes to feel like what difference we are doing, but we do. We are documenting. We have to push the wheel, and I'm sure the others may join one day. So thank you. Thank you for the hospitality. Thank you for the Bosnian sisters and friends for hosting us here as Palestinians. I just read today about a journalist who was killed 30 years ago for not leaving, refusing to leave. He was murdered. And all of my colleagues who I tried to convince some of them to leave Gaza, and they had the option, they refused to leave, and they still work. So they are the true heroes. Thank you.
That was Lubna Masara, journalist and Middle East Eyes Palestine and Israel bureau chief based in Jerusalem. Another great speaker who participated at the media roundtable was Asal Rad, a scholar of modern Middle Eastern history, a fellow at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C., and author of The State of Resistance, Politics, Culture, and Identity in Modern Iran. She spoke about the underlying biases of Western media. Let's take a listen.
Honored to be part of an event that's so important and with so many esteemed colleagues to be discussing this. And I don't want to overlap a lot with comments that have already been made. So hopefully I can just build on those comments and we can have more of a discussion. What I think it's interesting as I've been listening to everybody speak, obviously, I thought Victoria's point was so interesting about how we have these alternative medias and younger generations are not reliant on sort of mainstream legacy medias in the West, which is true. And we're happy to know that. And that's part of the reason why you've seen, I mean, I'm in the United States. I've grown up in the US. We are, when it comes to the issue of Israel-Palestine, I don't think, I mean, there might be debates about other European countries that do this, but we're quite propagandized in terms of the way the entire narrative has been framed for decades. And so while we're focused on Gaza because we've watched a live stream genocide unfold every day on our phones, on our devices, in a way that we haven't seen before, A, because of the level of atrocity, and B, because of the access that we have to that information, because, and I think we've talked about this, but it's always important to emphasize, because of Palestinian journalists on the ground. It is, I don't know what word to use, maybe remarkable, to think about the fact that Palestinians have to report their own genocide because their Western colleagues refuse to call it that. That is, I think, one of the issues that we'll be studying for years to come. How the Western world, which champions the idea of a free press, and we can talk about what a free press actually is supposed to do, but that champions this idea of a free press as a foundation of their democratic liberal societies, have completely failed in acknowledging the slaughter of their colleagues because they're Palestinian and because the perpetrator of those crimes is Israel. The fact that they've failed to report what is actually happening, and the fact that they've whitewashed Israel's crimes throughout this genocide, as we've seen. And so the narrative shift that you've seen in the US, where there's actually now polling where Israel has lost favor, lost quite a bit of favor in the American populace, is because of those very sources, the fact that there is social media, the fact that we're, despite the fact that the mainstream media is not showing you these stories, people are still seeing them. At the same time, I would say that legacy media still has a huge role and influence in the broad narrative. especially because we have aged societies. Like there are people, there are many, many people over 30 who are still looking at these broadcasts, whether they're watching it on television or whether they're, you know, reading a newspaper, reading something on their phones. I think there's another part where social media actually plays a factor, because a lot of individuals in the public are not following these events the way that we necessarily are. And so the way that they're getting information is passive. As you're scrolling through and you see a post or a headline, and this is why I focus so much on headlines, that passive way of receiving information is how thoughts and ideas are being shaped. And this is essentially how propaganda works. If you repeat something over and over and over again, it starts to stick in people's minds and they assume that it's a truth. For instance, if you've ever heard the phrase, Israel has a right to defend itself, because it gets repeated over and over and over again. But you never hear the phrase, Palestinians have a right to defend themselves. Palestine has a right to defend itself. Iraq has a right to defend itself. Iran has a right to defend itself. Lebanon has a right to defend itself. That phrase is never uttered. But Israel has a right to defend itself is repeatedly said until this becomes an ingrained concept within the mind of the public. And so this brings me to the sort of question, again, not repeating the fact that I think we've covered a little bit about how, you know, how dehumanizing language works, how whitewashing works by lack of attribution to Israel, not naming Israel as the culprit, how framing is important. We've discussed all of that. So let's just talk for a moment about what is a free press? What's supposed to be a free press? What's the difference between what we call a free press in the West and an authoritarian under, or the press under an authoritarian state? Well, in an authoritarian system, there's no journalistic freedom, theoretically. And that means that journalists or these institutions, media institutions, simply repeat what the state says, because there's no space in which they can challenge the state narrative. That's precisely what we've seen occur in terms of how Western media has covered the Gaza genocide. Just the fact that they don't use the word genocide to describe what is happening. The fact that there have been UN reports that concluded that Israel is committing genocide that get basically no coverage in the West. When the largest human rights organizations in the world, such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, come out with reports saying Israel is committing genocide, meaning they've concluded that Israel's actions constitute genocide, it's still framed as allegations. And within the same headline, you get something that says, Israel denies this, as if the party committing genocide has an equal say in whether or not they are committing genocide, and not the institutions that were created to prevent said genocide from happening. So what you've seen in the Western media is a repetition of whatever is the Israeli state says, Israeli officials say, as truth. It's presented as truth. Israel says, is often, you don't even have to see Israel says. You'll see headlines that say, you know, 50 Palestinians, well, I wish they would say 50 Palestinians killed, but, you know, 50 people killed in Israeli airstrike targeting Hamas. It doesn't even say Israel says they were targeting Hamas. It just says targeting Hamas, stated as a fact, when those 50 people who died, most of which were women and children, clearly not targeting Hamas. So this is the kind of repetition of Israeli positions that you see, as well as US government positions. When it was the Biden administration, whatever the Biden administration said, that was repeated in the news. If President Biden said, questioned the death toll, which he did very early on in the genocide, dehumanizing Palestinians in the process, that's when you see the emergence of this phrase, when he says he doesn't trust those numbers, of Hamas-run health ministry. And the media picks this up and everybody starts using it, all to undermine the numbers, which are actually underestimates. The number of people killed, we do not know, but we just know it's much higher than what we've actually been able to see, because the chaos on the ground doesn't really allow for accurate counting and measuring and identifying of bodies. Just imagine how many thousands of people are still buried under rubble and they cannot be retrieved because Israel destroys the heavy machinery needed to retrieve those bodies. So the idea of the free press is supposed to be to challenge the state and to tell the truth. It's not to point out what both sides are saying. It's to say, what is the truth? And that is what has been lacking in this coverage. And there's one more point that I wanted to make, and using a concrete example, because we've talked about this idea that a few of the speakers have mentioned Palestinian journalists and the fact that Western journalists have not, foreign journalists have not been allowed into Gaza. But you have Palestinian journalists on the ground. They're trying to do this work, and they are doing this work. The reason why there's reporting lacking sometimes in the Western world is because they don't listen to Palestinians on the ground. So the horrific story of 15 Palestinian medics slaughtered by Israel, which Israel lied about, after burying them in mass graves, crushing their ambulances and burying those along with the bodies. Palestinians were reporting that this was happening many days, about a week before the story finally started getting played on mainstream media. And that's only because the UN finally revealed a mass grave with aid workers, with 15 aid workers still in their, you know, still wearing their uniforms in mass graves with crushed ambulances. So it wasn't until the UN actually revealed the grave that Western media started to pick it up. And what did they do? They started repeating whatever Israel said. As the story came out that Israel was clearly lying, which has happened repeatedly, they were forced to say, well, this casts doubt. This is the framing. This casts doubt on Israel's story. No, Israel lied, because Israel lies repeatedly, but you'll never see that phrase used. You'll never, not only will you never see the phrase Israel lied used, but they will continue to cite Israeli sources as being factually true, despite the many, many lies that they have been caught in. So this is the sort of picture that has been created where whatever Israel says is fact, Palestinians who are actually the ones being slaughtered and are reporting their own news have to be verified somehow by some outside source in order for it to have legitimacy. And we can discuss, I mean, this is a separate conversation, I think. We can discuss the racial bias, the racism, the anti-Palestinian bias that plays into, the anti-Muslim bias, all of these layers that play into how the story is being told. But the reality of it is the story is not being told, at least not by the mainstream Western press.
That was Asal Raad, a scholar of modern Middle Eastern history, a fellow at the Arab Center, Washington, D.C., and author of The State of Resistance, Politics, Culture, and Identity in Modern Iran, speaking at the Gaza Tribunal final session held in Istanbul, Turkey, in October 2025. On December 19, 2025, Palestinian journalist and writer Saja Hamdan spoke at an event held at SOAS University of London, in which she discussed how governments and media outlets have turned a blind eye to Israel's genocidal war in Gaza. Let's listen to portions of her talk.
I am sure that the majority of people, they don't know about this aggression simply because Israel was not attacked like in October the 7th. So I always ask the people one question. A lot of people know about October the 7th, but who knows about 27th of December 2008? In that very date, I was just 10 years old. I was waiting for my school bus in the middle of the street. I was living in Tel El Hawa neighborhood, Al Abraj Street. I was in the middle of that street waiting for my school bus at 12 midday. And if you ask me why I'm waiting my school bus at 12 midday, I will say simply because in Gaza we have two shifts, two school shifts, the morning shift and the evening shift. Simply because in Gaza we, like, it's very crowded. We don't have enough schools to have only one shift for children to go to the school. And I was in the evening shift waiting for my bus at the middle of the street in front of the residential tower that my family and I used to live in. Then suddenly at that main like time, an Israeli airstrike started at the street. The both ends of the street were bombed. I only saw black flames, fire, people screaming, children running, shards of glasses just fallen above of my head and shoulders, and so on. I remember that day I ran to my mom screaming, "Mom, it's the end of life. It's the end. It's the last day of life. It's the day of justice, as we say, we Muslims." Then when I get older, I discovered that Western media described all the events that I lived in that day simply as Israeli strike. They erased all the crying, the screaming, everything I lived in that very day, simply in that very short term, and allowing people to read this very cold headline while they were simply drinking their hot coffee or flipping the channels or drinking their hot chocolate. I didn't want to be a journalist anymore, simply because it appeared for me that it's not that we are invisible. The world chose not to see us. After two years of hyper-visible genocide, while media outlets turning blind eye about what's happening in Gaza, using their own terms to describe the children, for example, as young people and so on, visibility doesn't produce action. Not because people did not sympathize with us. A lot of people did, like people like you. But the problem was in governments. Media played a role like they are completing the role of political complicity and political regimes. And I discovered that there is no democracies. Governments are the same in the whole world, even in the global south or in the global north. But the difference that in the global south, dictatorships are clearly declared, while in the global north, dictatorships are addressed by democracy. They are like just bragging that they have democratic regimes, they have systems, we have elections, but they ignoring the voices of the people who were protesting in the streets every week at the United Kingdom, for example. And I discovered that it's really pointless to be a journalist. But I still believe in the human. I still believe that humanity should lead and govern and dominate, and that's why we are here today, to still educate ourselves and to educate our children, not only about how Palestine will be free, because Palestine will be free, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but definitely someday. But the problem is to educate our children how the whole world could be free as Palestine.
That was Palestinian journalist and writer Saja Hamdan speaking at an event held at SOAS University of London on December 19, 2025. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.